Hi, welcome to Pod Goddess, conversations with the kick-ass women of the podcast world. I'm your host, Sibet Partee. This week, I'm talking to Theo Balcom, the senior producer of the New York Times, The Daily. Theo Balcom was a supervising producer of All Things Considered in DC before making The Daily with the New York Times. I met Theo at the Work It Festival in October in LA. I was walking into the theater at the Ace Hotel and spotted her in the lobby before a panel and walked up to her, so excited to talk to her. And we ended up sitting together for the panel and chatting, and then she agreed to be on this show. And I had the best conversation with her. I adore The Daily and I adore talking about it. So I think that you all will enjoy this episode. It was so surreal to meet all of these women at the Work It Festival that I idolize and listen to every day. I was inside the hotel, the Ace Hotel, where the event was held, and I saw Jenna Weiss Berman, who is the founder of Pineapple Street Media, and I was like, is that Jenna Weiss Berman? Oh my gosh. And I was so struck by my realization that was her, and then also by my nerves of, oh, should I go talk to her? What should I say? I don't know. That I stood in front of the door too long, and then the doorman said, oh my gosh, I'm sorry, ma'am, and opened the door for me as if I had been waiting for him to open the door, and I was mortified. I was so embarrassed. And then I thought, oh crap, I lost my opportunity to talk to Jenna Weiss Berman. And then with one of my friends that I had made, Aria, she is another, she's a recent graduate, whereas I'm, you know, still in my fourth year. But we made friends and we were having dinner on the last night. She had talked to Jenna via Skype during one of her college courses. And so she waved at her and I waved at her through the glass of this place where we were eating this really cool vegan invented yummy. And Jenna came in and sat with us and chatted with us for like 20 minutes. And it was so great to have that kind of contact with the people that you admire and for them to give you that kind of time. And I'm so lucky that they gave me that time not only at the Work It Festival but also here on Pod Goddess. And so without any further ado, I introduce you to one of my heroes, Theo Balcom. Yay, exciting. So I first wanted to get going by asking you a little bit about how you got into audio specifically. Is that chosen branch of journalism? You were at All Things Considered before starting The Daily, and what attracts you to the audio medium?
Right. So I, when I was in college, I knew pretty from a pretty young age that I wanted to be a journalist, but I wasn't exactly sure what kind of journalism I wanted to do. And so when I was in college, I went to school in New York. I went to Barnard College, and I got to do a lot of different internships to kind of try out different avenues. So I was at ABC News for an internship for a little while, and so there was one summer where I had to go back home to Maine, and where I'm from, and I didn't particularly want to go back that much. I had been spending the summer in New York, and I kind of wanted to stay there, and so I was sort of bummed that I had to go back. But I just Googled summer in Maine internship, and up popped this internship program that was for the public radio station there, and I was like, huh. I'd grown up listening to public radio, and I didn't know too much about it, but I liked it, and I had never really considered that it was something that I could do, but I said, okay, I'll just go ahead and apply for this. And then I ended up getting it, and I had a great summer, and I realized, like, oh, this is something that is, it's really accessible, you mm-hmm. know, like there's not a whole lot of barriers to entry. Because in some ways you're just like talking to people and finding interesting stories that you're excited about. And so I came back to New York and I got an internship at WNYC. And I was at this show called The Takeaway, which is still on the air. But at the time, it was brand new. And when they first made The Takeaway, they marketed it as like the alternative to Morning Edition. And they were going to be really kind of live and kind of like shock jockey in a way. Right. Like, the whole show was live, and it was on from, like, it started at, like, 6 in the morning or something. So I was seeing up close this very unusual show, this, like, very live, very new broadcast experience, and it was really exciting. And so I was sort of hooked by then, and that was when I was like, okay, kind of like NPR bust. And I applied for this internship at All Things Considered, and then I was lucky enough to get it. And then, you know, all my other friends after graduation were like, okay, well, what are your plans? You have this internship. And I was like, yep, and I'm just going to stay there. I'm just going to stay there, and I'm going to get hired. And everybody sort of thought that was not a great idea.
Why didn't they think it was a good idea?
Because I was sort of putting all my eggs in one basket.
Yeah,
right?
You're like, I'm going to work here. They're like, okay.
Yeah, and also who knew, you know, nobody knew what it was actually going to be like to do that kind of work,
right,
or if I would really like it. I was moving to D.C. at a time when most of my friends were staying in New York.
Right, right.
And so it was kind of a leap, but I don't know, I just had this, feeling that this is what I needed to do. And so that's like how I got to audio for the first time, yeah.
And when you talked on your Work It Talk about how the podcast is an evergreen medium, which is something that you're trying to push this daily broadcast show into something that you can access at any time, always, but still daily.
Yeah.
What does the podcast form allow you to do? Like, what was percolating in your stomach that you were like, I need to get into this space instead of the broadcast space?
So when I got the job at All Things Considered, the supervising producer job, which was like, you know, when I came in and I was an intern, I kind of looked around and I was like, okay, what jobs do I want to do here? And I landed on that one, and I worked really hard to get there. And then I kind of thought once I started doing that, like, I'd feel fulfilled and everything would be great. And I would feel like, okay, this is the place I wanted to get to in my career. And now I got here and I'm satisfied.
Yeah.
And instead what happened is I got there and I thought, okay, I really like what we're making. I like doing this job. I feel like we're making a really great show, and we're taking this show that has been around for many years and trying to make it sound different, and I'm happy that we're doing that. But I realized that if my friends and family weren't in their cars from 4 to 6 in the afternoon, they weren't going to hear what I was making. And I knew that what we were making was really good, and I knew that there was an audience for it. And I also knew that this was a moment where podcasts really were becoming pretty mainstream. I mean, maybe that's too strong a word, but when podcasts were becoming very popular, audio in general was becoming very popular, and so there was this divide. There was this huge market of people that really wanted to listen to audio. Yeah. And then there was this gulf between those people and what the broadcast space was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, why aren't we meeting the people that really want that audio and want it anytime they want and are only growing, right, are only multiplying those people? We need to meet them where they are.
Yeah.
And so that was when I really started pushing strongly for a daily news show and an on-demand daily news show. And at the same time, the Times had relaunched their audio team. They had brought on this woman named Lisa Tobin, who's the executive producer of the unit. And she had come up with the idea to make this elections podcast with this guy named Michael Barbaro.
Right, right.
And so they were pushing in that space, and they were seeing real success there. And when that sort of wrapped up, it was like, well, you know, we know we need to fill this hole in the daily space, and that's how I came on board. So it really was motivated by, like, wanting to make a thing for my friends.
Right.
Wanting to make a thing that I knew people wanted. I knew as a consumer people wanted. And I also knew that it was possible. Like, the other thing that sort of I think people say a lot of times about young people is like, oh, well, they don't want traditional news. You know, they want a BuzzFeed type experience, like a I mean, not sort of the investigative reporting that BuzzFeed does, but like, you know, they want
something
light
to click on. Yeah,
they want clickbait. They want shallow things.
Right, right.
And I knew that wasn't true. And so, yeah, that's some of how I ended up making the show.
Oh my gosh, you have been extremely successful in my friend group. I have to tell you that when my friends
and
I will be,
thank you.
Yeah, no, The Daily is a true a part of my life. It's the I listen to a lot of audio, but it's the first thing that I listen to every day when I wake up in the morning. There's a culture around it. Like my friend Julian says that the most depressing thing is when you've pulled an all-nighter and then the daily hops in your feed. like he judges like all-nighters based off like he's like, crap, the daily has come out, like I've been up all night. And we'll like I'll be talking about the news with my friends, and someone will take
that makes
a take
me feel that, so good.
Yeah, it'll be like something that's directly from the daily, and I'll be like, yes, so and so, we all listened to the daily today. We know that's not your idea. You got that from Michael Barbaro.
You can't pass that off as your own. Yeah, yeah. No, that makes me feel so good because, I mean, what I do really believe is that this thing needed to exist
so
and,
much.
You know, when you get told like, these people won't want it, or that won't work in this form or whatever, you know, when you keep getting told that, like, it's so satisfying after you've been able to actually see it to fruition and then know, because sometimes we do forget, like I do forget that there are, you know, legions of people listening to it, because you can be so much in your own bubble just trying to put things out all day every day.
Well, it's so accessible. The thing that not even just it's a daily news show that's always going to come into your feed, it's going to be a podcast, you can play it on demand, that's accessible, right? But in terms of being I don't want to say an easy listening experience, but it's very tangible. Like one of my favorite things is when you're talking to Mike Schmidt and he's in Kinko's and he says the bit about like not wanting the Russians to like take his laptop.
Hey
Sorry, so I got the folks here at Kinko's to let me use the phone.
How did you do that?
I told them I needed to call the office. But the problem is I got my laptop on the other side of Kinko's here. I'm afraid some Russian spy is going to take it, so I got to keep my eyes on it.
Right. I got so excited about that. Oh, my gosh, I can totally see where you are. And you talked in your work at Dialogue about, oh, my gosh, you could have agonized over how that's not in the studio. This is a huge story that we're breaking about Comey. But, hey, like it's right where it's happening, and you can enter the world. I have never felt more – I grew up just right outside D.C. in Alexandria, and I've never felt more – inside Washington than when I was abroad listening to the Daily. I wonder how you made the decision to say things like Michael Barbaro will sometimes say, oh, I'm tired, we've all been up all night, how about you, you know, something like that will slip in there. How did you make the decision to leave in that kind of rapport?
Yeah, so it's a balance, right? Because we want to make sure that we have authority and people trust us and they, you know, it's not like slapstick goofball stuff. But we also know that we want to create relationships between the reporters and Michael and the listeners. And so I think especially at the beginning, as we were all kind of learning, you know, we think of the reporters on our show as kind of like our family, you know, we have this like recurring cast of characters and it's like, you know, in comes Aunt Maggie and sometimes Uncle Matt's there, you know, like
you feel that as a listener.
It's like a fun, right. And I think the way that we cultivated that, well, first of all, it's not a cultivation because it is a real thing. Like Michael is truly you know, a dear colleague of most of these people. So so that familiarity is already there on the on a deep level. But then on the surface, you know, we tried to play up those relationships kind of in the beginning. And I think at first I don't think people realized that we were recording the whole way through. So, you know, you'd get people behind the mic and they'd start saying sort of funny stuff. I mean, obviously we always, you know, okayed it with them. We weren't doing some kind of gotcha thing. But, but at first I think people didn't quite know exactly what we were up to. And so we would use a lot of those moments. And now the time has passed. And also because the news has really become a lot of days it's so dire. It's sort of a jarring juxtaposition if you were to do that all the time. But we still love doing it because – I mean, the thing that I think you have to understand as a listener is that the people who work here are just people, you know, at a time when I think there are wildly different views of who journalists are. And also there's an idea of a Times journalist as a specific sort of authoritative figure. Mm-hmm. They're just people, too. And so I think that's part of what we're trying. That's one of our missions, too, is to illustrate to people like, everybody who's here doing this work is doing this work as a human and not an automaton. And that's one of the cool things that we can do with those little moments.
And you do it so you've never made me feel more like I could be a journalist, but also like I need to be really, really smart and work really hard to be there, because you can feel the relationships between the people and you can feel them as humans, but you also understand how smart everyone is and how much art goes into also making your show. I'm excited to talk to you now a week later rather than on Friday after this two-part series having come out. Bassem Razzo, the two-part series on him.
Today, Bassem Razzo lost his family and his home in a U.S.-led airstrike in Mosul. Video of the attack shows the strike hit its target with military precision. So why was Bassem targeted? And how often does this happen? Part two of the story.
And I wonder, how do you take a story like that and how do you construct an arc? Because in the first episode, we don't yet figure out what kind of reparations he's going to have for the American government or why the why his house specifically was targeted or how we're going to move forward. Where do you know to make that split in a two-part story?
Yeah, so that is one that has been really long in the making, and it's the terrific work of Lisa Tobin, who edited it, and Annie Brown, who produced it, and they worked with the investigations team, which is obviously a really powerful body here at the Times, and that team let us know the story was coming a while ago, and so we worked to roll it out with them. And the way that they kind of collaborated is they were able to talk to Bassem, and Michael talked to him for a while. It was a really meaty conversation. And coming out of it, Lisa and Annie just sort of thought like, well, you know, we could just have him be a part of the they were thinking of it as a two-parter at that point because they knew there was so much to get in. But they said, you know, we'll probably put Bassem in the first episode and then the second episode will be mostly the reporter. But they went into this conversation with Bassem and it was so good that they just thought, well, why don't we spread him over too? And why would we have to make him shorter? You know, like there's kind of a feeling around here that like we can do what we want to do, you know, there's no like set rules. So I think that was partly behind the decision. And then, you know, the desire to craft a narrative around something like that is always to figure out where we can keep a kind of lingering curiosity. I don't think we'd necessarily ever want to do like a cliffhanger that doesn't really feel like us, you know. That's another thing about the show that I think people respond really well to, that we're not showy in
a
way.
No, you're not playing your audience at all. You really are like trying to access them.
Yes. And we're not trying to put on any kind of tricks or hype up the drama unnecessarily.
Right.
Like the drama is already there.
Yeah.
We don't need to do anything more dramatic. So I think that's why they decided to break it up the way they did. But it really came from a close collaboration with the investigations team early on. And that's one of the things that we're able to do more and more now that we've been around for a while, is really get in on the front end of reporting and be with people as they're doing the work that they're doing. And obviously we like that a great deal more, because then we can really start to shape our narrative at the same time that the print reporters are doing the shaping of theirs.
What was it like for you to come into the New York Times, to come into this cohort that has this relationship already, and you're coming in as the producer? As I understand from your talk at Work It, this was an idea that you had, that you were sort of shopping around as the New York Times was looking for something. You sort of met in the middle. Like, this wasn't that wasn't a job that was advertised that you signed up for. You were actively pushing this show and this idea. So how did the merging of those two worlds meld together?
Yeah, so I had talked to them about a year before the show launched, and they, as I say, it was a lot of it was tied to the run up, the success of the run up.
Yeah.
And you know, basically the desire to make the audio team grow. You know, we have an amazing boss here named Sam Dolnick, who's really committed to the team, and just thinking about the way that the Times can branch out and do things beyond the print. And so he was a big champion of the audio team. And so I think it was like, in retrospect, it's a really, really obvious use of the Times, because it's what we're set up to do, that almost nobody else is. Like, you have to have a real reporting arm. You have to have desks all over the world. Yep. You have to have really strong sourcing in Washington. And that's something that very few newsrooms have anymore. And so in retrospect, it was like, yeah, of course the Times should make this. But really, it was a sense of timing that you know, the run-up had been so successful. You had a really amazing host named Michael Barbaro. You knew that there was an audience that was out there. And you know, there's a whole lot of reasons why this lines up with what the Times wants to do, right? Which is like a great deal of strategy trying to reach people who wouldn't normally access the Times, right?
Yeah.
So it lined up in a lot of really smart ways.
And what is your daily role like in the office of The Daily?
Yeah. So I am the managing producer, which basically means that I come in the morning. We have somebody going to the 9:30 meeting, which is where they gather information about what the desks are working on, what kind of targets reporters are trying to hit that day, that kind of thing. And then we all gather, the rest of the team gathers, and we have a discussion about what we are most interested in. And then I kind of figure out who can do what. So, you know, what makes sense for this producer to work on this day and what makes sense in Michael's day for him to do which interviews. And then just thinking about programming more generally, like, are we sure we want to do that segment? Does it really match up with that other segment? And, you know, we have this other thing that's coming down the pike. Should we wait on that? Or, you know, editorially, like, is this really something we want to touch today or do we want to wait? You know, it's like making those kinds of decisions about what's going to feel newsy and timely and right for our listeners and then how we can actually accomplish it with the staff that we have. So then doing a lot of like, okay, logistics. So here's how many hours we have in the day. Here's how we're going to get done what we need to get done. And then right now I'm really involved in the actual making of the thing too, right? We started this with four people. So I've been, you know, doing the bulk of the producing of the show. And then as we bring on new people, then thankfully I get a little bit more time to take time to produce things and also figure out like general strategy around how we're gonna get it done. So I'm doing a lot of the actual production of the show where, you know, we're figuring out how to edit the interviews down, what kind of outside archival tape we're going to use, what kind of scoring we're going to do, and then monitoring the news as the day goes on because lots of things could change, right?
Right.
So figuring out like, oh, I see this alert or I see this thing on Twitter. Do we need to adjust the show so that we get that in? How are we going to handle that? And then that's just like a lot of kind of editorial balancing. So it's like, okay, well, we know we have this show and it's all really planned and beautiful and isn't this nice, but this news just happened and we really do have to respond to it. So
yeah,
it's kind of a balancing act there.
And you have that built into your show at the end, like the sort of other things you need to know today, which I think is really smart. So you've if you're working on a story that you set for a day, but there's another piece of breaking news, you can incorporate it in that way. And
that's right.
That brings me to another question. I'm wondering how you manage the practicality of it, of making The Daily, with the art of it. Mm-hmm. Like, there's one small detail I love. I will never forget getting out of the shower. And Trump had some quote of saying something stupid. And then you followed by putting in this piece about the stars colliding and scientists witnessing that and the little, like, bloop sound.
Mm.
And earlier this year, an observatory in Washington State detected an unusual signal coming from a small constellation of stars in outer space. Soon after, a global team of astronomers spotted a new pinprick of light in the night sky. It faded from blue to red and then vanished. On Monday, scientists revealed what they had heard and seen.
Today, we're thrilled to announce that scientists have detected gravitational waves coming from the collision of two neutron stars, the smallest and densest stars. This event occurred 130 million light years from Earth in a galaxy far away.
For the first time, astronomers had observed the collision of such stars, which is believed to have played a key role in the formation of the universe and is responsible for creating almost all of the world's precious metals, including uranium, silver, and gold.
And I just started weeping early in the morning before class, because it was in this moment where we're talking about all this chaotic news and things that, you know, our news and our nation seem to be at such a crisis, that another universe was born. And we witnessed that. Like, we may never cross if there's any kind of intelligent life, but that happened. And how did you know to put that as a button to your show? Like, it completely just brought me out to this greater picture of the universe. And it seems like there's such a kind of important moral, like, larger picture scope of the daily that you can put in with, like, a detail like that. And Barbaro doesn't explain anything after that. I think the episode ended there. But you assume your audience is smart enough to sort of make that connection and feel that emotion through your audio. How do you make those artistic decisions?
Well, we have so many people who love those like celestial headlines. Yes. I think it's so interesting. People respond really. I mean, I think we've only probably done a handful of them, but people respond so, as you're saying, viscerally to them.
Gotcha.
I don't think we really thought that much about that one, except that we were excited about. You know, we're excited about astronomy in the same way that it seems our listeners are, and we wanted to follow that kind of curiosity. Along the lines of the question of kind of artistry and that kind of balance, I think that what we're always up against is that we have these huge ambitions, and we have to figure out when we can meet those and when we need to stop. And that's really hard, because when you get a whole group of people together who are wicked ambitious, super, you know, detail-oriented, perfectionists, you know, you just want to keep going and going and going and going and going. At a certain point, you have to say, like, okay, we only have so many hours in a day, and in order to get something that's going to be able to go out to the world, we're going to have to pause on this right now and just put out what we have. And so I think that's like that's the artistry debate that I think about a lot, that in the time that we're given, how can we make the most impact?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, in the time that we have to prepare this show, you know, and so you hear this, you'll hear us do a lot of like very highly produced beginnings of segments, for example, because we feel like if we make an impact with you there, you really are understanding, you're getting it. You're taken to another world.
Yep.
Or you're, you know, shocked by something, or I don't know, whatever the case may be. And that makes a really big impact. Or we also try to do very, very impactful ends of segments. Because then you kind of leave and you're lingering.
That.
You know, we And so we kind of make that calculation of like, okay, that is going to be the thing that you're going to be left with. And so we're going to put a lot of love into that.
Yeah. Oh, that's so – I like the word that you use, loved, because it does feel like the daily is a labor of really smart love. I want to ask you about when your very first episode of the daily, and you talked a little bit about this in your Work It Talk, about hoping that Neil Gorsuch was going to be nominated because you had the Benner interview for him, and you guys are all huddled in a corner, the new audio team waiting to see if it's going to be him who's nominated because you have that better interview, and you're screaming yes when he gets it, and everyone else in the newsroom is sort of looking at you like, what are you doing? And I'm wondering what it's like, just more on a personal level and as a journalist, to wish for a certain kind of daily news so that your show can be better. How do you find yourself thinking about the news differently because you have a show that's going to use it?
Well, I mean, selfishly, we'd like all news to happen between, you know, 9 and 4 o'clock. That would make make our lives a lot easier. You know, other than that, I think, you know, we don't really wish for anything. We just are following the most interesting things. Like, I think the only thing that I would wish for is that we would be able to let all the news that was going to unfold during office hours, and then we'd get a little more sleep.
What are the hours like? Because I assume that this is not a job that you can ever really turn off from. So, what are the hours like?
Yeah. So as I say, we come in and we have a morning meeting at around 10:15, 10:30. Yep. And then we're usually recording things around 1 to 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Sometimes it gets a little later depending on the reporter deadlines. And then from there, we're just in post-production basically until we're done. And sometimes that takes a little bit of time and sometimes it takes a long time. So it really just depends on kind of reporter schedules as well as how ambitious we want to be with the stories we're telling.
Gosh, so exciting. There are some episodes that are led by the print journalism and some episodes that are led by your team. And that the episode with Derek Black was one of those.
Yeah.
Derek Black left the white nationalist movement he was poised to help lead, betraying his family and friends in the process. After leaving, he came to see it as a fringe movement, on the margins and reprehensible to most Americans, which is why he has been shocked by the events of the past couple weeks.
How did you go and pursue that story? And
this is fun.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that.
So I, did you see the Post story about him that came out?
Yes.
So I read that and just thought it was like one of the best things I'd ever read. Oh my gosh, what a good story.
Uh-huh.
And at the time I was working at All Things Considered. And I said, I pitched it at the meeting one day and we tried to book him and he was really shy from doing press and he totally understandably, right?
Right,
like,
yeah.
You know, he's just had his whole life story told in the Post and that was what he wanted to say and that was what he wanted to say for that time.
Right.
So of course we respected that. And then Charlottesville happened and I turned to my colleague, Lindsay Garrison. And I said, Lindsay, did you ever read this piece in the Post with this guy who, he used to be a white nationalist and he was raised in this family. You know, I told the whole story and she's like, yes, of course, Derek Black.
Yeah.
Said, yeah, Derek Black.
Yeah.
She said, oh, I've been trying to book him on the BBC. She was at the BBC.
Okay.
I've been trying to book him on the BBC for years. She had read about him when he first posted the Southern Poverty Law Center letter.
Right.
When he first kind of left the movement. So she had been hot on his tails for years. And so I said, geez, you know, how great would it be if we could talk to him right now? And I don't really think he'll talk to us because, you know, I tried to book him before and he wasn't really into it. And she was like, I just think we should try.
Yeah.
So I said, okay. You're thinking, she's crazy. It won't happen. No way. This guy is very understandably not wanting to talk.
Right.
And then 4 hours later, she had him on the phone.
How did she do that?
And the reason is because he really respects the show.
Oh.
He is a fan of the show. And he said, you know, this is a place where nuance is embraced.
Yes.
And I am all nuance. And... you know, he doesn't know where best to share his story, but he feels like The Daily is one that is open and giving time and space to complicated issues, and so that's why he talked to us.
Oh, how exciting! That must be so rewarding to hear that too. Wow,
it was amazing.
Oh my gosh, how cool! It reminds me of Michael Barbaro was in one of the early episodes saying to his interviewee. Well, it was about the place that didn't want to provide contraceptives in their health insurance for their workers because it was against their religious beliefs.
David Green, he's the owner of Hobby Lobby.
And he was saying to Michael Barbaro,
when we were providing, and the liberal press will never say this, they will never say that we offered 16 different contraceptives, and I don't see you doing it, and I don't see you telling them that. The public that we pay 2/3 of the people's insurance, that our minimum wage for full-time people is $15.35, that we have a clinic that takes care of everybody's health for free that has our insurance. That way you guys won't write because it doesn't fit your narrative, does it?
Well, the beauty of audio is that you're saying it and our listeners are hearing it.
When you're editing audio, how do you think about that voice and the balance between that voice and Michael Barbaro's interview voice versus the narration and the reporters? How does that balance play in?
Specifically with Michael or with the guests themselves?
Specifically with Michael, but specifically with more difficult guests that are unlike Derek Black trusting you, maybe people that are more cautious of talking to you. How do you bring out their voice?
Yeah. So you, I mean, the first thing is that you want to explain to people that, like, we're a podcast, we're recording, this will be heard by other people. So that's, like, the first thing that we do to make sure that people understand what we're up to. And then, you know, we try to make clear that, like, the thing that you're going to hear or the questions you're going to be asked are going to be edited down, but they're not going to be so edited down. Like, we're, you know, we're going to be true to you and we're going to give you ample time and opportunity to share who you are and where you're coming from.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, when you talk about balance, that's an interesting, that's an important thing that we do, which is that, you know, Michael doesn't talk very much.
Right.
The people who talk the most are the guests who, you know, we want to be really fair to. We want you to feel like when you come on the show, you're able to express how you feel, make the points you want to make, and that Michael is going to push back when he needs to push back, or that we're gonna you know, interrupt you when we need to explain something that you're saying. But, like, for the most part, you're going to be able to speak. And, and you know, for the most part, we really haven't had difficult guests, I would say. Most people who come on either know the show, know what we're up to, or they, you know, are just willing to talk to us. And a lot of that also has to do with the amazing reporters at the Times who very much paved the way for us, right? Like, a lot of times the people that we're getting on are people who have already had, you know, sometimes weeks, months, years of relationships with our reporters.
Right, right.
So they already trust the brand.
Yeah.
You know, they trust the paper. They trust when somebody calls and says, I'm calling from the New York Times, they usually trust that we're going to do right by them.
And I feel like, too, you can hear the reporters, and especially Michael Barbaro, you can hear them listening. Like, I think in that.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Really, it's a very specific way that, especially Michael asks questions after with almost a pause, like you're saying, he doesn't talk as much, but you can feel all the intent behind that question, and it makes you as a listener listen more intently. Like in the coal miner episode,
when
he begins to cry, you feel that and you're put right there. And I'm wondering, this has been a project that you have imagined and put into reality, and I'm wondering, what other kinds of imaginations do you have for The Daily? And specifically talking a little bit about following up to this, I want to talk a little bit about the kids episode that you all are going to release on Sunday, if you're allowed to talk about that, because that is
so
exciting to me, because one of the things that I was going to say about The Daily is I grew up NPR kid listening to Morning Edition all my life, and I remember very distinctly looking at my mom in the mornings over breakfast and thinking, you understand this and I don't. Like, I remember aging and understanding it more, but I just remember thinking, wow, like, I could almost see the wheels turning in her mind, like her understanding the policies, her understanding the people, and I totally didn't get it. And now, of course, I'm, you know, 22 listening to The Daily, so I don't have that same kind of, oh, what would it be like as a kid listening to The Daily? But what I love is, Michael Barbaro asks questions that you know he already knows the answer to in order to get the guest to say what the piece is about.
Yes.
And as a kid, I didn't really hear that on Morning Edition.
Right. I mean, that's right, right. That's the beauty of the best kind of host. The best kind of host is the one that's asking the questions that you have.
Yes, yes.
And you feel like, you know, you're leaning in because you understand that this person is just as curious about the things that you're as curious about.
Totally. And how are you all adapting that for kids, or what kind of thought has gone into that?
So basically, we are doing this one time kids daily,
so cool.
And we went roundabout about how to do it because there was like so many possibilities. And I think where we all ended up was that we just really wanted to hear kids' voices.
Yeah.
We wanted to hear Michael talk to kids.
Uh-huh.
So the segment is going to be about these two sisters. They're twins. And one of them is a Girl Scout. And one of them has decided to join the Boy Scouts.
Oh, cool.
And so it's this really cool conversation with the two of them and their dad about how they decided to do it. And, like, why one feels more at home in Boy Scouts and one feels more at home in Girl Scouts. And, like, it's a real kind of, like, kind of grown-up discussion. Not in, like, a grown-up snoozy way, right. But in a, like, you know, we're talking to 11-year-olds, but we're talking about real stuff with them.
I wasn't actually as concerned about it until third grade, and then I started to think about, like, how I was not being the way people expected me to be. Mm-hmm. And I've had, like, classmates in school say, like, why are you wearing boy clothes or why do you have boy hair? That means you're a boy.
Mm. Cool.
Because I think we also, you know, one of the things that I think people respond really well to in the regular daily is that we're never talking down to anybody.
No,
we're
never.
We're never sort of saying, like, you should know this, so we're going to tell you. But we didn't want to do that for kids either. You know, we really wanted to, like, be a thing that kids would feel like, yeah, you're on my level. Like, you're going my speed. And, so I'm excited about the episode.
Oh, so exciting. I can't wait to listen to it and share it with. I have little brothers who are small and little cousins, and totally will share that around.
Cool.
And this show is called Pod Goddess, so it's about women podcasters. Yeah. And The Daily is very women-centered. You have a bunch of powerful women making it.
Yep.
And what is that like to work with all these amazing, smart women on The Daily?
It's the best. It's I've never been in an environment like this.
Yeah.
And I think when you're making a show, you know, when you're making something brand new, when you're launching it in a very short period of time and you're doing it every day and you're making, you know, it's like a brand new form that we're making.
Yeah, you totally
are.
And
I think that feeling supported by the people I work with, like, more than any normal workplace, and I need that support, and I get that from these amazing women that I work with. And I think that it also just makes an environment where, like, it's very – I think we're almost to an unhealthy degree. We're like, oh, no, I'm so sorry. I interrupted you. Like, please keep going. You know, like sometimes we can't even get through a meeting because people are so not wanting to interrupt each other.
Right.
Like, it's
awesome.
A very it's just an environment where everybody's voices are important, and obviously, you know, it's clear that you can be a leader here because all the leaders are women. So I also came from Barnard, which was a very
women's college,
centric environment. Actually, this feeds a lot into the kids daily because a lot of it is about, like, what it means to have a women-only space.
Mm.
And so Cleo, the sister who is in the Girl Scouts, really wants that space. And she really values it. And she thinks that she can, like, you know, do all the activities she wants to do and also in this space where she gets to just be a girl with other girls. And that is really satisfying for her. And her sister, Elsa, is like, no, I don't need the women-only space. I really want a whittle. You know, like, they have very specific desires. And, like, one of them, you know, sees this importance. And obviously, so anyway, all that to say that for me, like, being in a very women-centric space is a place where I'm really comfortable. And, like, I basically grew up in a matriarchy. Like, my grandmother's and, you know, we have very few men in our family. And, you know, sadly, my grandfather's died before I was born. But anyway, you know, I just am very comfortable in that kind of environment. And I think it's really rare, especially in podcasting, for, and in audio in general, you know, for bosses to, and for the majority of the team to be women.
Yes.
So, it's a really lucky thing.
Yes. And I also feel really motivated as a listener that is a woman and just listening to the credits at the end and them being mostly female names really gets me jazzed. When I think about The Daily, I think exciting. It excites me, and I'm so thankful it exists. So thank you for that.
Oh, and good. Well, I'm like the dark horse because you never know when you hear that name in the credits.
Oh, right. Oh, Theo. Oh, you wouldn't know. Oh, yeah. Oh, I guess. Because I had done listening to The Daily, I was like, oh my gosh, this is great.
Yeah.
I have to look up who all these people are.
So I always knew that
you were a woman. But yeah, I guess so.
I get funny reactions on the internet sometimes. Like, a guy recently tweeted at me. He was like, oh, so I love The Daily. And I looked you up and I was so excited to see that you're a woman.
Yeah. You're like, awesome.
Like, thanks, buddy. I think that's nice and not creepy.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. I know you have to go soon. So I'm just going to I have like three sort of quickish questions. And I'm going to rattle them off and you can sort of pick and choose. So my questions are, Where do you see The Daily going in the future? You've created this new form. How do you feel like you're going to further shape it? Mm-hmm. Second, mm-hmm. what do you listen to and how has that shaped mm-hmm. what you make? And third, mm-hmm. I end every episode with asking all of these women pod goddesses what advice they have for me as someone who wants to be a pod goddess myself. Mm-hmm. So pick mm-hmm. and choose from those three.
Cool. I would say that I want The Daily to never fall into a pattern. Mm, I think that what's fun about when you start something is you get to do things brand new and then you can kind of get into a rhythm. And I'm really glad we're in a rhythm and I like the rhythm that we're in. But I hope there'll be days where, you know, you turn on the Daily and we're like, we just do a chat show.
Yeah.
For
yeah.
Like
cool.
There's no theme. There's no outside audio. There's no scoring. It's just Michael having a really interesting conversation with somebody. I hope there's a day you turn on the Daily and Michael's in a place with
yeah.
somebody.
Cool.
I hope there's a day you turn on the Daily where I don't know yet what it sounds like. Like I just think there's a way to keep mixing up what we're doing, maintaining our dailiness, but pushing into other spaces that we don't know yet how they even sound. And I would say my advice would be to follow the things that you're most interested in. Find out what gets you going, what gets you revved up, what makes you feel great. And, like, be as specific as possible about those things.
Mm.
And then find the job that combines those. Like, yeah. I remember very early on being like, okay, so I know that I like, it was when I went to college and I realized, okay, I know that I like to do a lot of research. I know I like to talk to people about things that are interesting to me. I know I like to ask sort of awkward questions and maybe deeply probing personal ones at random events. And it wasn't great for my social life, but it was something I realized
I've been
myself.
Through many moments like that.
Yep. And once I kind of thought, like, okay, you know, those could be a job. Like, those things that make me excited. I like problem solving. I like coming up with quick answers. I like delivering. I like the success of a deadline. I like the success of handing something in and having it done. And I realized so much of that was like rooted in broadcast audio. I also love a performance. I've been a dancer for much of my life.
No way.
And,
cool.
Yeah, and I love the thrill, that kind of high wire act of like, okay, this is it. It's all on you.
Yeah.
You know, use your training.
And you made that happen. You made that job for yourself, too, with The Daily.
Yeah. So I think that, like, figuring out – and then, too, you know, I did things that I realized, okay, I went and I tried this, and then I tried to be really specific about what I didn't like about
right.
it. Like, okay, I didn't really jive with this part of it. And that seems like a big component of this other job. You know, I don't know, whatever it is specifically for you, but figuring out, like, okay, this gives me a good feeling in my belly and this really doesn't. Mm. And I think the other thing is just to let yourself off the hook a little bit. I was just talking to somebody. I try to talk to Barnard people because I really, really value my experience there and, you know, just credit them with so much. But anyway, I was talking to a Barnard senior and she said, you know, I'm going into my senior year, my senior spring, and, like, what should I do? And I said, I know this is really, really hard, but, like, you got to let yourself off the hook a little bit. Mm. Because my senior year, I was so stressed and I was so nervous. And I really thought that going to Barnard was, like, the best thing I would ever do.
Yeah.
And it was ending. And I was like, oh, my God, it's ending and I don't know what's next. And
yeah.
And I was so sad that I didn't really get to have that much fun. And I know it happened because it had to happen that way and that's just how I was wired. But, like, I wish in retrospect that I had given myself a little more breathing room and not been so anxious all the time.
Yeah, that's really good. Yeah, we call them fourth years at UVA, but really good senior fourth year advice.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So fourth years.
Fourth year.
Fourth year is it's like okay to give yourself some space.
Yeah.
And don't beat yourself up so much.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I'm definitely in that sort of like a little bit of beating myself up phase, but trying to trying to give it some space too. So thank you for that, and thank you for the daily, Theo. It's amazing, and I look forward to it every day. I'm sad on the weekends when I only have the New Washington, which is still great. And thank you.
Well, get ready for the sixth day. You know the sixth day is coming.
Yay! Yeah. Yes. So exciting. And you have a listener in me every day and in my little cohort of friends. No, big cohort.
I'm
a
so
lot
glad.
Of people listen to it.
I'm really glad.
Yes. And thank you for coming on my show today. And thank you for pursuing all of your interests in the daily and in your own life and professional career. So thank you.
Absolutely.
That's it, folks. That was Theo Balcom, the senior producer of The Daily. Pod Goddess is a proud production of Teej.fm, the podcast network of the University of Virginia and Charlottesville. Head to Teej.fm, Teej.fm, to hear more of our amazing shows. I've been your host, Sabet Partee. I'll see you next time on Pod Goddess.